Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Hello and welcome to Reality Check. Today is Tuesday, the 29th of December, 2009, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. And this is episode 21 of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. Reality Check is a show designed to give you a healthy dose of reality. And we do that by promoting the art of critical thinking and skeptical analysis. Each week, we bring you a roundup of LGBT news, followed by an in-depth analysis of an issue related to the paranormal or the pseudoscientific. And finally, we wrap up each show with a movie review. On today's show, after our LGBT news roundup, we're going to have a look back on this past decade and remind ourselves of just what a momentous decade it was for advances in LGBT rights. We'll then continue with our skeptical analysis that we began last week of the mysterious and terrifying subject of ghosts. Then, in our movie review section, we'll have a look at the latest dark comedy from the Coen brothers, A Serious Man. So for all that and more, stay tuned here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9. Okay, let's start with our LGBT news for the last week before we get into our roundup of the decade. Now, dear listener, let's go to breaking news and extremely exciting news because once again we have a major development in the continuing saga of where and who is going to perform the first ever same-sex marriage in Latin America. Now, this has been going on for 6 weeks now and has turned into a storyline as dramatic and convoluted as the most spicy Latin American telenovela that you can imagine. And I have to tell you, dear listener, my nerves are shredded from all this tension and suspense every week. But it looks like this week the story has finally come to its shocking and totally unexpected conclusion. And that's because just hours ago, the first ever legally recognized same-sex marriage in Latin America took place. And it took place not in Buenos Aires, not in Mexico City, but in the southernmost city on the planet, in Ushuaia, the capital of the province of Tierra del Fuego in Argentina. Now, who would have seen that coming, I ask you? A telenovela scriptwriter couldn't have come up with a better twist. Okay, let me give you the details. The wedding was actually between the couple who had won the court case in Buenos Aires several weeks ago, Alex Freire and José María Di Bello, but whose wedding, originally planned for December 1st, was blocked by another court decision just hours before it was due to go ahead. Well, it seems that the governor of Tierra del Fuego province, Fabiana Rios, is a supporter of equal marriage and was able to authorize the civil registry office in Ushuaia to perform the marriage. So, as far as I can tell, her authorization was completely valid and it was a totally valid and legal marriage between two people of the same sex. At least the newspapers in Argentina are certainly reporting it that way. So after that roller coaster ride of emotions up and down every week, it looks like Latin America has finally now seen its first ever legal same-sex marriage. Who knows what will happen in Argentina now? There are still several same-sex marriage cases coming before the Supreme Court, I understand, and the federal parliament is still debating a same-sex marriage bill. So presumably, hopefully, this will spread beyond the province of Tierra del Fuego, and very soon all Argentinians will be able to marry someone of the same sex, should they choose to do so. To find out what happens, we'll have to wait until the next decade. And speaking of the turn of the decade, well, as this is our last show of 2009, and also the last show of the decade, we're going to do something a little bit different tonight on Reality Check, and we're going to have a look back at all the advances in LGBT rights over these last 10 years, over the first decade of the 21st century. And I think it's no exaggeration to say that the decade was in fact the most momentous decade ever for LGBT rights. At least since the rise of the modern state about 300 or 400 years ago, no decade has ever seen more significant advances in civil rights for LGBT people. Very broadly, those advances mostly came in two fields: the decriminalization of homosexuality and the legal recognition of same-sex relationships. Let's start with decriminalization, and there were two really important decriminalization decisions during this past decade. The first occurred in June 2003, when the United States Supreme Court brought down the most important decision for LGBT rights in the country's history, in the case of Lawrence versus Texas. States of the US had gradually been removing their sodomy laws for the previous few decades, since Illinois in 1962, but with that 2003 decision, the remaining sodomy laws in 13 states of the US were all finally abolished. By the way, just to explain, sodomy laws are basically the laws that make homosexuality a crime. Now, this Lawrence versus Texas decision was something quite similar to what we saw a few weeks ago here on Reality Check in the 1967 Loving versus Virginia decision that overturned the interracial marriage bans still in force then in several states. The other really important decriminalization decision of the decade was handed down on the 2nd of July this year by the Delhi High Court in India. That decision effectively overturned India's sodomy law, and in terms of the number of people affected by it, I think it's no exaggeration to argue that this was perhaps the most important advance in LGBT rights ever in the history of the world, given that India has a population of 1.15 billion people. This High Court decision directly affected the lives of tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, of people. And this decision is actually being appealed right now in the Indian Supreme Court, so let's just hope that it's upheld. Now, apart from those two historic court decisions, this past decade was probably most significant because it saw, for the first time ever, full civil marriage opened up to same-sex couples. Denmark got the ball rolling back in 1989 when it became the first country in the world to introduce registered partnerships for same-sex couples, but it was only this decade, on April 1st, 2001, that the Netherlands opened up civil marriage to same-sex couples. This was the first time ever that a modern state had recognized same-sex relationships on an equal footing with opposite-sex ones. So the decade got off to a very good start in terms of LGBT rights. The rest of the decade saw same-sex marriage introduced in a further 7 countries. Well, actually 8, considering what's happened in Argentina today. So let me go through the list. After the Netherlands came Belgium in June 2003. Then just days later came a court decision in Ontario, Canada, that opened up marriage in that province. Over the next 2 years, we then saw various other Canadian provinces introduce same-sex marriage, until finally in July 2005, the Canadian Federal Parliament legislated to introduce same-sex marriage throughout the entire country. In the meantime, there was also a decision of the Massachusetts Supreme Court in late 2003 to open up marriage there, and that came into effect in May 2004, making Massachusetts the first US state to introduce full same-sex marriage. The next place to get it was Spain in July 2005, and then came South Africa the following year in December 2006. And in terms of the number of people affected, this was probably the most significant development because South Africa, with a population of almost 50 million, is the most populous jurisdiction to have introduced same-sex marriage so far. Well, Spain is pretty close too. It's got something like 47 million inhabitants, I think. Then these past 2 years have seen a further flurry of activity. California got same-sex marriage in June 2008, but it was, of course, taken away by the Proposition 8 referendum in November that year. A few days later, in November 2008, same-sex marriage began in the US state of Connecticut, and fortunately was not taken away there. Then at the start of this year, 2009, it came into effect in Norway, then a few months later in Sweden. Then in April this year, we had a surprise court decision that introduced it in the US state of Iowa. Then in September this year, it was introduced by legislation in the state of Vermont. And then, of course, today, our time, well, but officially yesterday, December 28th, local time, it looks like it got underway also in Argentina. And that's basically the situation as it stands at the moment. Same-sex marriage will also come into effect in the US state of New Hampshire in 3 days' time on January 1st, and hopefully in Washington, D.C. and Mexico City early in the new year, if all goes well. So for full legal equality in same-sex relationships, this past decade has been truly momentous. We've never seen anything like it. And finally, probably the other big development for LGBT rights this decade worth mentioning came on February the 1st this year, when we saw, for the first time in modern history, the world's first openly LGBT head of government. And that was when openly lesbian Johanna Suratotir became the Prime Minister of Iceland. Good on you, Iceland. So it has indeed been a momentous and tumultuous decade for LGBT rights. There have been advances and there have, of course, been setbacks. But I think it's quite clear that on the global scale, there have been 2 steps forward for every step back. So one can see a gradual, steady progress towards equality for LGBT people. Let's hope that continues for many decades to come, and not just in the West, but in parts of the world where it's most needed, particularly Asia and Africa. Okay, that's all our LGBT news and our decade in review for today. Let's listen to a song now, and when we come back, we'll continue our spooky skeptical analysis of ghosts. But don't be afraid, dear listener. Skeptics have an impenetrable force field against ghosts. We never seem to get attacked by them. So if you want a force field too, keep listening to Reality Check here on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9. Joy 94.9. Award-winning radio.
Welcome back to Reality Check. I'm Tony Pittman, and the station is Joy 94.9. And the song you just heard there was Finale Tango Apasionado by the legendary Argentinian composer and concertina player Astor Piazzolla. And that was taken from the soundtrack of the 1997 Wong Kar-wai movie Happy Together, set in Argentina, that tells the love story of two men from Hong Kong living in Buenos Aires. And of course, I played that song in tribute to the first same-sex marriage in Latin America being performed in Argentina just a few hours ago. And we are receiving some SMSs from listeners here in the studio. Thanks for contacting us. And we got one from Nick listening all the way on the other side of the planet in Tipton, England. So thanks for listening, Nick. Special greetings go out to you. Okay, we now move into the part of the show where we get into a skeptical analysis of a subject related to the paranormal or the pseudoscientific. And today we're going to continue a discussion that we began last week about a subject of worldwide fascination, the issue of ghosts. Last week, we had a look at the supposed physical evidence for the existence of ghosts, namely photos, videos, and audio recordings, and we concluded that when you really look into it, that evidence is not very compelling at all. So today, we're going to have a look at that other form of so-called evidence for ghosts, and I'm talking about the anecdotes, all those eyewitness testimonies, all those personal stories recounted by people who have supposedly seen or heard a ghost. The question is, given the sheer volume of eyewitness testimonies of ghosts, does that amount to good evidence of their existence? And the answer is, no, it doesn't. Anecdotes about ghosts are not evidence of ghosts, just as anecdotes about UFOs are not evidence of extraterrestrial visitation. They're interesting, they may be indicators that there's something to investigate here, but they're not evidence. This is because they're not substantiated. That is, they're not backed up by some kind of physical evidence to prove the truth of the claim. And anecdotes are made by humans, and even when people are genuinely recounting what they think they experienced, human perception and human memory are fallible. That's another golden rule that all skeptics need to keep in mind all the time. Now, I was having a discussion with a friend about this last week, and he pointed out that I can't say that anecdotes are not a valid form of evidence, because we rely on them as evidence all the time. We rely on people telling us what they saw or heard to make many important decisions in our lives. Courts use eyewitness testimonies to decide criminal cases. When we read the news, we rely on people's accounts of events to know what's happening around the world. When we read biographies, when we read history, when our friends tell us things that happened to them, we're relying on personal stories, anecdotes, eyewitness testimonies, whatever you like to call them, and we believe them. Most of the time, we have no reason to doubt them. So it's not true to say that we can't rely on anecdotes as evidence of what happened. We do, in fact, rely on them all the time. Well, that's absolutely true. We probably couldn't function most of the time without relying on stories and anecdotes that other people recount to us. But there's an important distinction to make here between everyday anecdotes and anecdotes about things like ghosts or UFOs. And here I'd like to refer to a rule of thumb often mentioned by the late great astronomer and skeptic Carl Sagan, and that is, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. So, for example, if a friend comes to visit me at my house, and when she arrives, she says that she saw a cute little possum in the tree in front of my house, I will most probably believe her. I have no reason to doubt her. That claim is not extraordinary. I've seen possums myself in that tree in front of my house. But if she says that instead of seeing a possum, she saw a flying saucer and it hovered above her and then some strange grey humanoid creatures descended from the saucer and scanned her with laser beams and then got back into their spaceship and flew away, well, I'm going to have my doubts, because that's an extraordinary claim. I've never seen a flying saucer. And extraterrestrial creatures have never been shown to exist. Therefore, as a skeptic, I'm going to need more than just her story to believe that she really did see a spaceship piloted by extraterrestrials. She's going to need to substantiate her story with some kind of physical evidence. Did the extraterrestrials give her something? Some gadget, maybe, that relies on technology way beyond anything we have on Earth? Because unless she can substantiate her story, I'm going to conclude that the most likely explanation is either that she's trying to fool me, or, if she seems genuine, that she's had some kind of dream or hallucination or some other unusual psychological event. So that's the key here. Extraordinary claims need extraordinary evidence, and pure anecdotes will most likely never constitute extraordinary evidence. Now, speaking of anecdotes, I'd like to recount a couple of anecdotes that people told me about 3 weeks ago when I went on Paul Anthony's talkback show on Friday afternoon, The Conch, here on Joy 94.9. Now, we got a lot of calls about ghosts, and most of the callers just wanted to tell us strange experiences that they'd had and couldn't explain, and had put them down to the activities of ghosts. Now, first up, there's one really important observation to make here. People were telling us stories. I wasn't there when those events occurred. And the events were not videoed or recorded in any way. So we're faced here with the problem of what really happened compared to what the person says happened or what they think happened. We're hearing their interpretation of what happened, possibly with the benefit of hindsight. For example, I got a call from one woman who told me that she was sleeping in a house with her partner one night, and they were the only people in the house, and during the night they heard a tapping sound coming from the fireplace, and it was tapping SOS in Morse code. You know, the dot 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 dash 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 dot 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 for SOS. Now, I don't think that woman was hoaxing. I think she was genuine. But again, here's the problem with anecdotes. Her story is totally unsubstantiated. No recording was made of the events. We are completely reliant on her memory of events. And more specifically, her memory of her perception, her interpretation of the events at the time. Even if she did hear some tapping sounds, was her perception of the Morse code SOS signal accurate? Or maybe was that something that she thought about later? In hindsight, maybe she thought, oh yeah, now that I think about it, maybe those tappings were something like a Morse code SOS signal. Oh yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what they were. Yes, they were definitely a Morse code signal. They were definitely saying SOS. And maybe after recounting that story several times to friends, and with the passage of time, it becomes hard even to remember the original event separate from the way that she's always told the story. Now, I'm not saying that this is what happened, this is what she did, but you can see the problem here. Without any evidence to back up the claim about what she heard, it's impossible to know what really happened. Also, the other thing about all the supposed ghost stories that people told us on the show is that, well, I believe that all the callers were genuine because they never really said anything very extraordinary. They never said, oh, a ghastly, ghoulish, translucent figure appeared before me and said it had a message for me from the other side. They were all just slightly strange incidents or sounds they'd heard or things they'd seen that they couldn't really explain. And in fact, that's what most ghost stories, genuine ghost stories, are like. For example, one guy talked about staying in a cottage on a vacation and how once, when he was all alone inside the cottage, he heard a door slam. Yet there was no wind at the time. And later, he found a plate that didn't match all the other crockery in the cottage, and he's sure it hadn't been there when they arrived. Okay, so those are slightly odd occurrences, and maybe we'll never be able to explain them. But the problem lies in the huge jump in logic from saying, something odd happened that I can't explain, to saying, I therefore conclude that a ghost did it. Now, when you think about it, that's just logically inconsistent, because effectively you're saying, I can't explain it, and at the same time, I can explain it because it was a ghost. The story should just end with the first statement, I can't explain it, full stop. End of story. We regularly see and hear lots of things that we can't explain. We get confused, our attention gets distracted, we misinterpret things we see or hear, we experience optical illusions, our senses can deceive us, there's nothing mysterious about it, and most supposed ghost sightings happen at night, when it's hard to make things out clearly. Well, no surprise there. And most importantly, we always have incomplete information. We are not omniscient demigods. We can't know everything. Some things we'll just never be able to explain. For example, I lost a sock in the washing the other day. I don't know where it went. Maybe I'll never know. So what? Life is full of things like that, that you can't explain. That doesn't mean a ghost did it. That doesn't mean that spirits of dead people move amongst us. One of my favorite quotes on jumping to conclusions like this comes from Joe Nickell, the legendary American paranormal investigator. He talks about how when placed in the context of a supposedly haunted house, all these small, unexplainable events of everyday life suddenly take on a whole new meaning. Here's the quote. Once the idea of a ghost appears in a household, no longer is an object merely mislaid. There gets to be a dynamic in a place where the idea that it's haunted takes on a life of its own. One-of-a-kind quirks that could never be repeated all become further evidence of the haunting. End quote. So, finding a plate in the crockery cupboard that doesn't match the other plates suddenly becomes the sign of a ghost. It's ridiculous, but this is the type of conclusion that people can reach when they're not thinking critically. The other reason why it's not legitimate to jump to the conclusion that a ghost did it comes down to Occam's razor. Now, I'm not going to go into a lengthy explanation of Occam's razor today because I already did that back in episode 13 when we were talking about UFOs. So if you really want to know more about Occam's razor, go to the website realitycheckonline.net and download episode 13 of Reality Check. But in a nutshell, Occam's razor is a rule of thumb that says that when you have several competing explanations for something that happened, the best explanation is the one that involves the fewest assumptions. So let's look at these ghost stories and apply Occam's razor. If you're in a house alone and you hear a door slam, the explanation that involves the fewest assumptions is that something in the physical, material world caused the sound of the slamming door. Maybe it was the wind after all, even though you hadn't noticed that there was a slight breeze. Maybe there was someone else in the house, but you didn't know. Maybe there was an animal that pushed the door shut. Maybe a door slammed in another building, but for whatever reason, it sounded like it was coming from inside your house. Maybe it wasn't a door slamming at all, but something that sounded like that. Maybe you had an hallucination. Or it could be any one of a myriad of other explanations, all based in this material world that we know and understand. So why is an explanation based on the wind better than one based on a ghost? Well, because we already know that wind exists. You don't have to assume that something exists that's never actually been shown to exist, like a ghost. So if you want to explain why you heard a door slam, the wind, or an animal, or another person, are all better explanations than saying a ghost did it. Because we already know that wind, animals, and people exist. We don't know that ghosts exist. Deciding on the ghost explanation would involve a huge and unnecessary assumption to explain what happened. And actually, just for the purpose of showing how Occam's razor works, let's imagine a hypothetical situation where you were able to eliminate all possible earthly causes for making the sound of a slamming door. It's ridiculous, but let's just imagine it for a moment. Now, in that situation, it would still be more reasonable to say that an extraterrestrial from another planet is a more likely explanation than a ghost. Why? Because it involves fewer assumptions. An extraterrestrial creature would belong to the physical world, a world that we know exists. We also know that other stars exist and other planets too. We don't know that extraterrestrial creatures exist or that they're visiting Earth, but still, that explanation involves fewer assumptions than a ghost from the supernatural world, because we don't even know that the supernatural world exists. In fact, we have no evidence or reason to believe that a supernatural world does exist. Therefore, the explanation that assumes the existence of this whole other world, apart from the material world we already know, is going to be the least satisfactory explanation of all the possible alternatives. And, well, if you're going to assume that it must have been something from the supernatural world, then why assume that it was a ghost, a spirit of a dead person? Why not some other supernatural being? I mean, we don't know anything about the supernatural world. We don't even know that it exists. So why presume to know what kind of creatures inhabit it? And really, why a ghost? Why not a god or a goddess? Why not an angel or a demon or an incubus or a succubus or a witch or a nymph or a fairy or a banshee or a hound of hell? And those are only a few examples of supernatural creatures from Western culture. There must be millions of supernatural creatures that humans have believed in at various places and times in history, it would seem to depend on the culture you grew up in as to which type of supernatural creature you believe is responsible for the sound you heard. And anyway, why should it be a supernatural creature that humans have believed in? Why not one we've never even heard of? Anyway, I'm being facetious, but I hope I'm making my point clear. If you're going to assume that the best explanation for something you perceived is a creature or being that's never been shown to exist, why choose that particular being that's never been shown to exist over some other being that's never been shown to exist? And there's yet another major problem with the ghost hypothesis. Step back for a moment and think about how the world would be if ghosts really did exist. If people's spirits or souls continued to hang around and tried to communicate with the living, then why would they only ever appear to people when it's dark, when it's night, when it's hard to see clearly, when they're alone, when they're in some spooky, out-of-the-way place, when they have no video camera? Why is it always only ever in ambiguous situations where there are always other possible explanations? Why do spirits always choose to appear in those kinds of circumstances? Why doesn't a ghost ever just appear clearly and unambiguously in the CNN news studio during a live broadcast? Or somewhere where there are many people able to record the event? If you're a spirit and want to communicate with the living, wouldn't that be the way to do it? Why hasn't that ever happened? Not even once? Well, as a skeptic, you'd have to say that the most likely explanation for why ghosts don't do this is because ghosts don't exist. Now, maybe a final thing to say about ghosts is that probably one reason why the belief in ghosts is so widespread and persistent is that it's related strongly to a belief in life after death. And that idea provides comfort to a lot of people. If ghosts exist, that means that human consciousness continues after death. That's a lovely thought, even if you are afraid of ghosts. Of course, just because something is comforting or nice doesn't mean that it's true. And that's where the skeptic comes in, to try to find out the truth, even if it goes against some of our more comforting beliefs. And at this point, I'd like to end with one of my favorite quotes from Carl Sagan. And the quote goes like this: "It is far better to grasp the universe as it really is than to persist in delusion, however satisfying and reassuring." I've rarely found a quote that better sums up the skeptical worldview than this one. Now, finally, before we get into our last song for today, if you have any questions or comments about what we've covered on the show, or maybe something you'd like us to cover on the show, please feel free to send us an email. The address is realitychecktony, T-O-N-Y, at gmail.com. You can also visit our webpage where you can find previous episodes of Reality Check. That's at realitycheckonline.net. Okay, let's listen to our final song for today, and when we come back, we'll get into this week's movie review.
Hello, this is Katie Lang on Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check with me, Tony Pittman, on Joy 94.9. Also streaming live at joy.org.au and also available as a podcast to listen to anywhere in the world on your little pod. The song you just heard there was Into the Ocean by American group Blue October from the year 2006. It's movie review time here on Reality Check, and the movie up for review this week is A Serious Man, the latest offering from the highly prolific Coen Brothers. The Coen Brothers are two real brothers from Minnesota in the USA who have written, directed, produced, and edited a number of very successful films over the last 30 years or so, including Fargo, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, and No Country for Old Men. Their latest, A Serious Man, is a dark comedy set in 1967 in a Jewish community in suburban Minneapolis, Minnesota, and is loosely based on the Coen brothers' own childhoods growing up in such an environment. It tells the story of Larry Gopnik, a physics professor with a wife and two children, whose comfortable routine work and family life suddenly starts to unravel. His wife asks him for a divorce so she can marry a family friend, Cy Abelman. And I have to say, the performance of Fred Melamed, who plays the two-faced, condescending, manipulative Cy Abelman, is one of the best in the film and definitely the funniest. Now, Larry is also offered a bribe by a student who failed his exam, and the university committee that is considering Larry's application for tenure is receiving anonymous defamatory letters about him. He's also having trouble with his brother and his kids and a property boundary dispute with his neighbor. His wife and Cy Abelman then ask Larry to move into a motel so that Cy can move into the house. Larry seeks the advice of three rabbis to help him deal with these crises and moral dilemmas that have suddenly emerged. A Serious Man is a very enjoyable movie, but it should be said it's not a straightforward laugh-out-loud comedy. It's a movie about a number of deep philosophical and moral issues, some of which are dealt with in a relatively explicit way, others more obtusely. There are many scenes or plot developments that leave you wondering, what was that all about? What are the Coen brothers trying to say here? Part of the confusion may be that the lives of all the main characters are deeply embedded within the Minnesota Jewish community. And if you don't know much about Judaism, probably some elements of the movie will be partially lost on you, as I think they were on me. But it's mostly because the Coen brothers wanted to make quite a cerebral film that will keep people guessing. I read one review of A Serious Man that said that the film is more interested in posing questions than answering them, and I think I'd agree with that. So it's not always an accessible film, but it is intelligent and extremely well-crafted filmmaking, and a refreshing break from the spoon-feeding that's so common in Hollywood movies. It's the type of movie that students of cinema will be analyzing for years to come. What's the meaning of the old Yiddish fable in the prologue? What's the point of the story about the dentist who finds Hebrew letters engraved on the inside of one of his non-Jewish patient's teeth? What relation do the lyrics of the Jefferson Airplane song, Somebody to Love, have to do with anything? Once again, it seems to me the point is not to answer these questions, simply to pose them. Some reviewers have described A Serious Man as a modern-day adaptation of the biblical story of Job, a man whose faith is tested when terrible calamities befall him for no apparent reason, which is really a way to address the so-called problem of evil, that is, why horrible things happen to good people. Ultimately, I think the main theme of the film is summed up in the quote that appears on screen at the very beginning. It's attributed to Rashi, an 11th century French rabbi, and it says, "Receive with simplicity everything that happens to you." And I think that this is the essence of the movie. How should we deal with what happens to us, what life throws at us? With gentleness, or should we rail against it? Should we just accept what comes our way, as Seneca might have advised, and just change our perspective on things in accordance with what happens, as suggested by the first rabbi that Larry visits? Or should we be proactive and fight against what comes along, even if this may be futile? How much influence can we actually have over the course and direction of our lives? Can we determine our own fates? Is it our will that determines what happens to us, or just random chance events? Are we just like helpless leaves floating down the river of life? And why do things happen to us? Is there any sense to it, any meaning in it all? So, as you can probably tell, this is really a movie fundamentally about the meaning of life. It doesn't answer any of the questions, but A Serious Man is good, serious filmmaking, and I reckon it's not a bad way to spend 105 minutes of your own unfathomable life. And that brings us to the end of the 21st episode of Reality Check on Joy 94.9. I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to send any questions, comments, or feedback to realitychecktony@gmail.com and visit our website at realitycheckonline.net. And remember to tune in at 10 o'clock next Tuesday for episode 22. Have a great week, everyone. See you next week. And see you next decade. Bye-bye.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.